We'll move on to the number three case of today, United States against Tuggle, appeal number 20-2352. And we have Ms. Pham, who will be arguing, and we're waiting for Mr. Keenstra. And hello to Mr. Palmer as well. So, Ms. Pham, are you just finishing up at Notre Dame?
Yes, we had our last class yesterday.
Last class yesterday. All right, congratulations.
Thank you.
I see Mr. Keenstra's appearing there. So, Mr. Keenstra, can you see and hear us yet? Mr. Keenstra, can you hear us?
I can. Yes. Thank you.
All right. Great. I've called the case, and we'll go ahead and hear from Ms. Pham on behalf of the defense.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Vivian Pham. I'm a law student participating in Notre Dame Law School's appellate moot court program under the supervision of attorney Robert Palmer. I represent the defendant, Mr. Travis Tuggle. The decision of the district court to deny Mr. Tuggle's motion to suppress should be reversed because Mr. Tuggle had a reasonable expectation of privacy over the whole of his movements outside of his home, and that they would not be monitored by a poll camera continuously for more than 18 months. First, the warrantless use of poll cameras when operating for 18 months created a detailed record of Mr. Tuggle's life, and they were in an unreasonable violation of his expectation of privacy. Now, while mere visual observations do not intrude upon a reasonable expectation of privacy, the poll cameras here did what was more than what could be visually observable. They did more than what a nosy neighbor could see or even a trained police officer could see.
Ms. Pham, on that question, does the record reveal how high the cameras were on either of the poles, either the first, second, or third camera?
No, Your Honor, we don't have in the record any information about how high the cameras actually were.
Thank you.
But certainly, yes, Your Honor, they'd certainly be higher than any fence that Mr. Tuggle could construct.
But there's no contention here, though, that they were used to look behind fences, as in that earlier Fifth Circuit case, is there?
No, Your Honor, there were no fences and no contention that they had to look over fences to be able to see the front of Mr. Tuggle's home.
Ms. Pham, would you agree that just the mere, the brief use of such a camera is not any more unreasonable than just, for example, having an undercover officer climb a utility pole and observing for a few minutes? So, and what I'm trying to push you toward is conceding that what's actually relevant here is time, not the technique.
Your Honor, we think the time is the deciding difference. However, we do agree, or we do argue, that the use of the poll camera, that it was able to zoom, pan, tilt, and create that record of 18 months in the use of the poll camera itself is relevant. And Your Honor, the fact that it was able to record for 18 months gave law enforcement the ability to see what was happening live, and then if they missed it, go back in the past to pause and probe the camera's memory. Now, while our expectations of privacy might be that we may sometimes be watched, we don't expect that we'd be watched by the government, and that when they watch us, they'd be able to have an unfailing memory, perfect vision, and an impeccable focus, and that they'd be able to keep that up for 18 months.
So the biggest problem that I have here, Ms. Pham, apart from Supreme Court opinions that take quite different approaches to different related Fourth Amendment problems, is the line drawing problem that Mr. Tuggle's argument poses. For example, does it matter whether it's a dense neighborhood or not? Does it matter whether the cameras are focused on a residence, a store, a mixed-use building, a multi family dwelling, and just how much technical capacity is relevant. Quite a, in addition, of course, to the time line that would have to be drawn. Can you suggest how we might be able to resolve those questions if we were to agree with you on the basic one?
Yes, Your Honor. First, I'd like to address the temporal limitations that the court would need to decide on, and then perhaps the practical limitations about the differences that a place would make in where the camera was placed. So first, as to the temporal limitations, we sympathize with the court, but the decision they'd have to make here is not easy. But both the Supreme Court in Jones and Carpenter did not specifically give a temporal limitation or draw a line in which a time period would make a search unreasonable. And we don't think the court needs to here. We think that it's enough to say that certainly 18 months of data is a search and is a search that requires a warrant. As to the particulars of the place in which the cameras are placed, we think the difference here is that the cameras, the poll cameras, targeted a specific individual outside of their home. In that respect, it's also different than any regular security camera. So security cameras aren't targeted to a specific individual, and they don't create that comprehensive record that reveals our patterns and associations like a poll camera does. They're not surveilling an individual in their daily private life.
Well, suppose we had a local police department that said, we're troubled by crime in our downtown area, and we're going to install a lot of CCTV cameras, much like, it was, for example, in the United Kingdom, and we're going to set up recording devices for all this. We've got the memory's cheap, technology's not unaffordable, so we're going to put the whole town. That I would think that would be more troubling to you rather than less.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the fact that the poll cameras targeted a specific individual is more troubling. And that's because it created a record that showed a comprehensive and detailed record of one individual's life. A camera just outside any government building or any other place wouldn't reveal those comprehensive details. They reveal snippets of information, snippets of events. Any record they gather might be anonymous and disjointed, as opposed to specifically targeted and continuous. And moments or events seen in isolation raise different concerns than long-term surveillance. So the Supreme Court in Jones and in Carpenter expressed concern that long-term monitoring could reveal a record that was detailed, comprehensive, and effortlessly compiled, revealing our sexual habits, our political or even religious beliefs. And it reveals information like when we spend the night at home, who we spend the night with, how long they stay there, what items we carry, what packages get delivered to our door. Until day in and day out, the government is able to essentially track our lives. In isolation, again, these events might not mean much, but together, these slices and moments and events in our lives create a mosaic, revealing to the government our patterns and associations of our lives.
Ms. Pham, obviously you were not trial counsel, but it is apparent from the two motions for reconsideration after the judge's ruling that this issue meant a lot to the defense. Yet there was a stipulation to the evidence that had been presented and no evidentiary hearing requested. Can you elucidate on that at all or give us any thoughts?
Your Honor, I don't know specifically why no evidentiary hearing was requested, but despite the fact that there was no evidentiary hearing, we do think that there's enough information from the information known that to rule that 18 months of surveillance by a poll camera outside of Mr. Tuggle's home was a search that required a warrant. And furthermore, Your Honor, practical limitations here, or the lack of practical limitations here, are relevant. In Kylo, the court noted that courts must assure to protect and preserve the degree of privacy against the government that existed when the Fourth Amendment was adopted. Justice Alito, in his concurrence in Jones, noted that in the pre-computer age, the greatest protections of our privacy were neither constitutional nor statutory, they were practical. So to preserve that degree of privacy that existed when the Fourth Amendment was adopted, the court should take into consideration how poll cameras are able to circumvent those practical limitations. So for example, the GPS surveillance in Jones was able to circumvent practical limitations because it was cheaper than physical surveillance. And because by design—
How would that argument apply to the government, for example, obtaining a DNA sample from a disposed coffee cup suspect?
Your Honor, we don't argue that using technology that could make a government's law enforcement's job easier or more efficient should be constitutionally suspect, that it always requires a warrant. But we think that the lack of practical limitations here are relevant because practical limitations force law enforcement to make decisions. They force law enforcement to decide who they want to watch, how long they are going to watch them, and decide what evidence they'd expect to find. But here, with relative ease, law enforcement are able to fashion a camera atop a light pole and leave it there for 18 months for some reason or for no reason at all.
Ms. Pham, are you suggesting a bright line rule like 90 days?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we don't suggest a bright line rule. We think, though, that 18 months is certainly a long enough sufficient time that the court could say that 18 months was an unreasonable invasion of Mr. Tuggle's privacy. And the court in Jones also noted that 4 weeks was an unreasonable and lengthy monitoring. The court in Carpenter, although the cameras suggested that it gathered 127 days of data, that 7 days of gathering that cell phone location data was an unreasonable search. So
Ms.
we think
Pham,
that certainly—
Do we know whether this camera captured more than Mr. Tuttle's house?
Your Honor, we know that it captured intimate details and events of his life, such as we know that—
I understand his. Does it capture the neighbor, too?
Your Honor, the third camera in specific captured part of the neighbor's home. It was his co-defendant who had a storage shed next to his house. So we know that captured that storage shed, but the other two cameras were pointed at Mr. Tuggle's home or the outside of his home.
Well, you recognize, as I think Judge Hamilton was suggesting, that in major metropolitan areas, there are now increasingly cameras in neighborhoods that are permanently, for all intents and purposes, installed. Would you question their continuous use that captured individuals like, in this case, Mr. Tuttle, and perhaps another dozen or two dozen more on the block?
Your Honor, while we do expect that we may be watched sometimes by neighbors, by third parties, or other people, we don't expect that it'd be the government that watches us. And that's the difference here. We might expect that, for example, when we consent to downloading Facebook on our phones and agreeing to the terms of service, that they might know certain things about us, or that when we have a house, our neighbors might be able to see some things that we do outside of our home. But the difference is that we don't choose for the government to watch us, and therefore we don't expect that they do.
If the government watched you enter the lobby of this courthouse because you wish, as a member of the public, to view a court proceeding, would that be an invasion of your privacy?
No, Your Honor, because first, that's a limited intrusion of just us, one person walking in at one time. And the Supreme Court has differentiated limited intrusions from long-term surveillance that intrude upon different expectations of privacy. And second of all, Your Honor, in this case, the poll cameras operated for more than 18 months, seeing an intimate window that created a comprehensive, continuous, and detailed record of Mr. Tuggle's life. Now, for the foregoing reasons, because Mr. Tuggle had a reasonable expectation of privacy, we ask that this court respectfully reverse the district court's denial of Mr. Tuggle's motion to suppress. And if there are no more questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Ms. Pham. Mr. Keenstra for the government.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jeff Keenstra, and I represent the United States. Law enforcement officers did not conduct a search subject to the Fourth Amendment by using cameras to record visual observations of things openly apparent to the public. Much in the same way, for example, that a neighbor might have both seen and recorded all these same sorts of things with a home security camera. In short, the officers saw only what was visible to the public, and they did so using only the same sorts of tools that are available to and in widespread use by the public at large. In doing so, they didn't infringe on any reasonable expectation of privacy, so they didn't conduct a search. Now, when it comes to searches and visual observations in particular, law enforcement stands at least in the shoes of the public at large. So, for example, in Serralo, because the public at large can fly overhead in an airplane, and it's accepted in society that the public does that, so can law enforcement officers. Likewise, for example, in the knock and talk cases, that because the public at large can approach a house and knock on the front door, so can law enforcement officers do that, even when their purpose is law enforcement and investigative related, instead of just a casual observer. And the reason for that is that what the public at large can do is what defines the right to privacy that you have and whether society would view that as reasonable. So in framing this issue, the question isn't whether you have an expectation that law enforcement in particular is doing something or seeing something, but whether you have an expectation that society at large, or at least a significant portion of society, could not be seeing or doing those things. And I think that's really where
Mr. Keenstra, I don't know how I would have voted on the Jones and Carpenter issues if anybody had asked me at the time before those were decided. But those were, the government was making, in essence, much the same arguments there in those cases, that the technologies did not reveal any information that was not also exposed to the public by those suspects. And the court said no. It took a pretty different approach. At least, well, the concurrences in Jones and the majority in Carpenter, in looking less at the techniques that were used and more at the sheer volume that modern technology allowed the government to collect about people. That's why I'm struggling, for example, then with the reliance on just the beeper or one officer going up to knock and talk on one occasion, as opposed to camping out on the front porch.
Sure, and I think the simplest way to distinguish that from this case is that officers did nothing that wasn't equally available to the public. So the defendant has a conception of a nosy neighbor, for example, as someone who's periodically looking out their windows. But in today's society, the reality is that nosy neighbors have cameras. And so a nosy neighbor with a camera could not only see these things, but could record them and could do so continuously.
Query, so Mr. Keenstra, though, query whether there's a distinction in why the word warrant comes to mind to people in some of these circumstances between a individualized or particularized placement of a recording device vis-a-vis Mr. Tuggle and something that's more broad-based, like a camera over intersection checking speed or a video doorbell that might be across the street. Those are not particular to Tuggle in the way that this was. Can you address that?
Yeah, I think that's true, but the Supreme Court has held that the targeted nature of an investigation is really irrelevant. And the Supreme Court addressed that in particular in Serralo in footnote 2 in the accompanying paragraph, where it said that it made no difference that there the officers weren't just members of the general public flying overhead. They were on a specific mission to detect marijuana in particular, and not just to fly overhead and see what they see, but to see it at this particular property. And the Supreme Court held that that made no difference at all, because members of the public could have equally flown overhead and done what law enforcement was doing. And I guess to get at the concern there about Jones and Carpenter especially, I think the key to understanding Carpenter is that what officers actually obtained there wasn't just the person's location, it wasn't observations of his location, it was his cell records. And those cell records, which contained the cell site location information, those were never made available to the public. Those weren't visible to the public at large. And so I think—
No, but the point of the comparison is not the specific technique used, but that they simply substituted for what a surveillance team could have discovered by watching the defendant's movements, right?
I mean, I think that is a correct distinction, but I think the Supreme Court has also clarified in cases like Kylo that the fact that you can access things in one lawful way doesn't give you license to conduct a search. So the example in Kylo was that you could camp out across the street from a house year round if you wanted to know who's living inside, but that doesn't give law enforcement officers license to barge inside to see who's there. And I think it's the same issue here, that the cameras captured only visual observations, only in the same sense that a passerby might have seen these things, that someone walking on the sidewalk could have, or that even a neighbor with a security camera might have seen all these same things. So I don't think the means that the officers used here really distinguishes it from what the members of the public at large could have done. And I think that is very different and an important distinction from Jones and Carpenter.
Do we have to worry about, for example, pole cameras with infrared capacity, with telephoto lenses, connected using artificial intelligence and facial recognition software?
I think there are problems that could arise with those sorts of technologies. Certainly in Kylo, if they're using sort of thermal detection technology where they're seeing something inside of a house, I think that's a very different case. Certainly that's not what happened here. In terms of facial imaging technology, I think that's another very difficult question. But I think that the search, if there was one, would occur when the images are captured, not when the police go back and process it. So I think that's, a difficult question. I'm not entirely sure how it would shake out, but I think it's a question that this case doesn't, because, again, the technology that officers use is something that's in general public use. So this isn't, some new advanced technology that's uniquely in their possession, like it was in Kylo, where they're using a thermal imager to see inside the house in a way that members of the public couldn't. To get to that point, though, I think there are limiting principles here. In the context of this case, the time isn't a limiting principle because it wouldn't have limited a member of the public. But the first limiting principle is what officers are able to see. So if they're seeing things that are equally available to a passerby, it's not going to be a search. But if they're looking inside windows, inside fenced-in backyards, that's a different concern. And then the second limiting principle is, if they're doing that, are they doing it in a way that a member of the public couldn't do equally? And I think the cases that sort of bracket that analysis are Sorallo on the one hand and Knotts and Kylo on the other. In Sorallo, they're flying overhead in an airplane just the same as a member of the public could, so that's acceptable, even though the defendant did have a fence erected in his backyard, which blocked view from some portions of the public. Conversely, in Kylo, they're using a technology that was not widely available to see inside a house. So I think really those two factors are what do provide the limiting principles here, but neither of those.
I'll be worried if Lowe's starts selling infrared security cameras. Your argument may take us.
I think that's a fair point, but at the same time, there's a degree to which the advancing technology inherently affects the expectations of privacy that we have as against society at large. And so, as Kylo explained, airplanes are a great example of that there was a time where you could erect a fence around your yard and be pretty sure that no one is flying overhead and seeing you, But of course, now that the public can fly overhead, we don't have that same expectation of privacy. So I understand the concern that innovations in technology can pose problems. But I think as long as law enforcement isn't advancing beyond what the general public can do, they're not infringing upon any reasonable expectation of privacy that the person has as against the public. And so they're not conducting a search. And I think the legitimate concerns that arise there would have to be addressed through legislation, through a constitutional amendment, and those sorts of means. I guess to further address Carpenter, I think that the court, as I've addressed a bit, didn't create a categorical rule that a person has a right to privacy against law enforcement learning certain types of information about them. I think that would be a pretty radical rule. And I think the fact that they were accessing the information through the cell records is really important there. There are, of course, many other distinctions. The information the officers accessed was otherwise unknowable. It literally could not have been compiled by by law enforcement because the person was going through public and private areas. That's not here, where the case here where the district court found, as a matter of fact, that everything that the cameras reported was openly apparent and visible to the public. I think there's also a distinction where Jones and Carpenter both addressed movements through public. And there are practical difficulties, certainly, of following a person around through public, especially when they're going both through public and private areas. But that concern just doesn't apply to observations of a fixed set location where it could easily fall within frame of a camera and be accessed by any member of the public. I think that the retrospective nature is important as well, which isn't a factor here. It was effortless in Carpenter for the officers to obtain those records. This investigation was anything but effortless for a significant amount of time. Law enforcement officers were watching these in real time, so they weren't just compiling them and going back. Of course, that was why it was valuable to them, that it gave them real-time observations.
But you don't think that's decisive here, though, do you?
No, it's not decisive, but it is a factor that distinguishes this case from Carpenter. Unless there are any other questions about the search, I'd like to briefly address the good faith exception. And I'd like to make 3 points, time permitting. The first one is that the argument is properly before this court. The defendant hasn't argued forfeiture, and so he's waived that argument. And in any event, the government did present the core of this issue to the district court, which was that appellate precedent authorizes this activity. Second, we're not asking to extend appellate precedent just to apply it. Of course, the Supreme Court has held repeatedly that visual observation is no search at all, that warrantless surveillance of a home is lawful. And in fact, in Kylo, the court even explained that it would be perfectly acceptable for law enforcement officers to conduct year-round surveillance of a home. A reasonable officer could believe that those holdings, which are, of course, binding appellate precedents, authorize this activity. And last, I just note that even if this court were to find that Davis doesn't cleanly fit these circumstances, Davis was but one of many contexts in which the Supreme Court has weighed and applied the two competing concerns that govern the exclusionary rule. And those are, first, that the sole purpose is deterrence, so officers have to be particularly culpable. And second, that deterrence has to outweigh the social costs, which are significant. Because, of course, in seeking to suppress evidence, the defendant seeking to distort the truth-finding function of a trial by excluding relevant and reliable evidence of his criminal activity, and eventually, or ultimately, is seeking to escape accountability and subject the public to his misconduct. So even if Davis didn't cleanly apply here, the Supreme Court's holdings, which are broad, if not addressing this very exact context, along with the circuit holdings, which uniformly in these circumstances have approved the use of poll cameras that didn't see into any protected areas, would allow a reasonable officer to believe that that this conduct was lawful under those precedents. So the deterrence value would be nil, and that would not be sufficient to overcome the social costs. Unless there are any other questions, we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much, Mr. Keenstra.
Thank you.
Let's see, Ms. Pham, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to address 2 points on rebuttal. First, I want to touch on the difference between limited intrusions that the Supreme Court has held to be reasonable and long-term surveillance. So this case is distinguished from short-term surveillance that the Supreme Court has held to be reasonable. In Zuralo, the court upheld the constitutionality of a plane, taking pictures over the defendant's backyard within the time span of a flight. In Dow Chemical, it was the same. They upheld the constitutionality of an aerial photographer who flew by, took pictures within the span of a flight. And again in Knotts, the court upheld the constitutionality of the limited use of a radio transmitter, which sends radio signals, commonly known as a beeper, over the course of a day to confirm that the defendant was meeting his co-defendant at one location. Those were limited intrusions, but prolonged surveillance of 18 months is different because it reveals our patterns and associations. Therefore, we respectfully ask this court to reverse the district court's denial of Mr. Tuggle's motion to suppress.
Ms. Pham, did you get to both of your points?
I did not, Your Honor.
What was the second?
Yes, Your Honor. The second was that long-term surveillance reveals different information, our patterns and habits that the public could not see. So in Carpenter, even though it gathered records and data from cell phone companies, the government and the public could have seen where the defendant went. They could have followed him around. They could have followed everywhere he went and known where he went. But the difference is that doing so would be impractical to the point of impossibility. Here, too, it's the same. Having a nosy neighbor.
All right. I think we have the point. Thank you very much, Ms. Pham. Our thanks to both counsel for the very helpful presentations in your briefs and the oral argument. And with that, the case is taken under advisement.